Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a new candidate running for President of the United States in the 2012 elections, representing a newly formed party, the Justice Party. The former mayor of Salt Lake City, Rocky Anderson, joins us to lay out his populist progressive third party platform that does not rely on corporate money or the mainstream media, but instead plans to energize grassroots people power that has emerged with the Occupy movements. Then we'll look into the dynastic communist succession in North Korea with the death of the Dear Leader and the ascension of his youngest son, Kim Jong-un, to head the world's most isolated country, which managed to develop nuclear weapons while a tenth of its population died of starvation. Christine Ahn, the executive director of the Korean Policy Institute, joins us. She has participated in several peace and humanitarian delegations to North Korea, and we will discuss whether a recent thaw in U.S.-North Korean relations will be sidetracked by tensions surrounding this leadership transition. Then finally, we will look into political rifts already emerging in Iraq following the final exit of the U.S. David Phillips, the author of Losing Iraq, Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco, joins us. He is the director of the Program on Peacebuilding and Rights at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and a fellow at Harvard University's Project on the Future of Diplomacy. We will discuss the scope of the strategic setback for the United States as Iran emerges as the winner of the Iraq War, and the wisdom of selling F-16s and laser-guided bombs to a corrupt Iraqi regime that appears to be allied with America's enemies. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rocky Anderson, who was the mayor of Salt Lake City from 2000 to 2008. During his time in office, he became known as a progressive voice in Utah politics. He currently serves as the president of the Utah-based nonprofit organization High Road for Human Rights and recently announced the formation of the Justice Party. And he's running as president of the United States in the 2012 election as a representative of the Justice Party. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rocky Anderson.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And how are you doing here with the Justice Party?
We just launched the party last week. I announced my candidacy for the party's nomination, and we're hearing from people all over the country. And by the way, we have a website, voterocky.org. And we're limiting campaign contributions to $100 per person. That's a great grassroots movement that we intend to be a very long-term sustained political force in this country.
And give us a sense of how you are influenced by the Occupy movement, because I take it you want to create a kind of a new progressive party in this country, perhaps along the lines of Theodore Roosevelt. So tell me what the broad political platform is that you're trying to get together and what constituents in this country you want to attract.
You mentioned the Occupy movement, and there is tremendous convergence between what we're concerned about and the solutions that we see and what I think the justice move or the Occupy movement is really all about. The overarching concern that is leading to almost every major public policy disaster in this country is the corrupting influence of money in our system, both our electoral system and the system of governance. We know, for instance, that the only reason that the United States is the only nation in the entire industrialized world that doesn't provide essential health care services for all of our citizens is the corrupting influence of money coming from the health care insurance industry. We would have a decent system in place rather than these horrid compromises we see, like under the Obamacare so-called program, that even if it's fully implemented, the day that it's fully implemented, there will still be 23 million people in this country without health insurance. The stranglehold that the military-industrial complex has on our nation. If anybody's wondering why our budget is totally out of whack, why we have these enormous historic deficits and accumulated debt and the interest burden, that by itself, every year, the money we waste paying interest would finance more than 12 departments of our federal government. Why is it that we're spending this kind of money, especially on programs that are really useless in our arsenal right now? It's because of the corrupting money of military contractors in our system and the way that we govern. The F-22, for instance, these contractors knew what they were doing. They lined up other contractors or subcontractors in 42 states so that they'll have people in the Senate and the House of Representatives that will fight for continued funding, although it's an obsolete weapons program. And it's billions of dollars wasted there. The financial industry, why did we see deregulation that led to this financial disaster? It's because of the corrupting influence of money in our system. And why don't we see people prosecuted for the financial fraud that contributed to this financial disaster that's impacted almost every person in this country so negatively? It's because, for instance, President Obama received more money from Wall Street last time he ran than any candidate has ever received. And he's on the way now to doing the same thing. And he surrounded himself with folks from Goldman Sachs, with folks that have benefited from this financial fraud and the government bailouts. The people of this country have been totally sold down the river because of the impact, the influence of corporate and other concentrated wealth in our government. And it's time to change that entire system. That's what we're talking about, and it's very much what the Occupy movement is all about.
Again, I'm speaking with Rocky Anderson, former mayor of Salt Lake City, who is now running for president of the United States under the banner of the Justice Party. And as we know, Rocky, there's a history in this country of third parties. I mentioned Theodore Roosevelt earlier, but essentially the two-party system has got the game rigged, and you're a kind of recovering Democrat, obviously, and you've proven to be very successful as a progressive Democrat in perhaps the country's most reliably conservative state, Utah. How will you not be a spoiler then in siphoning votes off on the left?
You know, that's really a great question, and actually it was a concern about being a spoiler that kept me from doing what I'm doing now for a fair period of time. And I know there are still people with that concern, but I think what we all need to realize, and this is what won me over and what convinced me that we need to create a new party and that I needed to run as a candidate, and that is we're never going to see a change in this corrupt system unless we all step forward and we say together, we're going to do this differently. We're not going to simply vote for the lesser of two evils among the Republicans and Democrats, because we know no matter which of those parties is in power, we're going to have the same corrupt system. We're going to see a betrayal of the public interest day after day after day. We know, for instance, that whoever's in power, Republicans or Democrats, will not provide the international leadership that the world so badly needs on the issue of climate change, on the issue of energy independence. They won't do it because of the corrupting influence of money coming from the gas, oil, and coal industries. The fossil fuel industries have poured in millions and millions of dollars into their lobbyists in Washington. And between that and the campaign contributions, the people of this country, people of the world, don't stand a chance in seeing good leadership in this country. So instead of letting fear of the lesser of two evils be defeated, we need all of us to affirm the fact that the people of this country have been organizing together passionately, tenaciously, that we've overcome the power of money and we've made this a better country. We saw it during the anti-slavery movement, the women's suffrage movement, the civil rights movement, the labor movement. There was a lot of money on the other side, but because people were passionate, they hung in there, they fought tenaciously, they overcame it. And we have the advantage now of democratized media democratized ways of communicating. We don't need hundreds of millions of dollars to put on these ridiculous television ads. We can communicate with each other and with people who want to see and hear these communications. And just think about it. There have been nations where people have overthrown dictators. We can do the same thing. We can overthrow the dictatorship of the corporate abuse and corruption in our government, if only we will.
So you're talking about an American Arab Spring here, Rocky Anderson.
It's very much a revolutionary movement. It's changing the system in healthy ways. But it's not at all subversive. It's democratizing. It's saying, bring back democracy to our nation. Bring back constitutional values. Look at the Republicans and Democrats, the way they've eviscerated our Constitution. We're now putting U.S. citizens on assassination lists, and not only killing them, but killing their 16-year-old son in the most recent instance. We're saying about war criminals, let's just look forward and not backwards. That's what President Obama said when he came into office. He loves talk about the rule of law, and then everything he does seems to completely undermine it. So this is about saying, we're not going to stand for this two-tiered economic system anymore, where there's a very small group of favored people, this financial aristocracy in our country, where there's a greater disparity economically than at any time in our nation's history since the 1920s. We're going to provide greater fairness, firmer foundation for the economic and social safety nets for the people of this country. And we're going to do it in a way where we're investing in the future, in our infrastructure, in education, in innovation, in research and development, to build the foundation of our country so we can compete against those nations that are doing it the right way. So it is a revolution, but it's a kind of revolution that really affirms our nation's greatest traditions and constitutional values.
So, Rocky Anderson, given that we have one party controlled by big oil and the other one by Wall Street, and the media is completely wedded to the duopoly and treats process, not context and content, as you can see from these debates that we're having in these primaries, it's all about process. Nobody really talks about big ideas except, in a way, Ron Paul on the Republican side. Do you feel, though, that the Occupy movement that has been zealously apolitical and doesn't have an electoral agenda, can you wed your ambitions to them? Because that seems to be, that's a spontaneous movement, a citizens' movement, a true bottom-up movement.
It is a very healthy movement in our country. And I don't blame people at all in the Occupy movement or anybody else for being completely disillusioned with our electoral system, because we've been betrayed over and over again. We've got a president now who promised hope and change, and he's done everything but provide any basis for hope and constructive change. There's been a lot of change, all right, but it hasn't been a good thing for this country. I mean, even the health care bill that was passed, the compromises that were made, he wouldn't even put on the table a single-payer health care system when the majority of people in this country who were polled said that they favor a single-payer health care system. And then what does he do? As soon as there's any opposition reflected in terms of a government option to compete with the health care, with the for-profit insurance companies, the public option, he just walks away from it, says, well, that isn't really necessary for health care reform. So what kind of so-called reform do we get? We get massively increased premiums. And the increases we've seen in our premiums in the last year are just the tip of the iceberg. It's going to be devastating for the people of this country. And still, as I said, 23 million people who are without any health care coverage. So in this country, our costs are double, at least least double per capita as compared with the average of the rest of the industrialized world. We don't provide, we're the only country that doesn't provide universal health care coverage in the industrialized world, and our outcomes are really mediocre in comparison with other nations. So that's about an F grade that we deserve in terms of our system as compared with all these other nations. And they do it very different ways. There are some single-payer, there's some multi-payer nations, but none of them rely upon for-profit insurance companies for their essential health care.
Again, I'm speaking with Rocky Anderson, the former mayor of Salt Lake City, who is now running for president of the United States under the banner of the newly formed Justice Party. And the president of the United States, I mean, is he really, has he deceived people, or is he simply in a situation where even the president of the United States does not have the power to fulfill his campaign promises because the power of the oligarchy and the special interests and the corporate plutonomy is such that nothing can be done?
That's just, that's not true. It's a great question, by the way. But we should never resign ourselves to saying it can't be done. President Obama has betrayed us in so many ways. It's not just a matter of, you know, the first George Bush saying, read my lips, no new taxes, and then getting in office and saying that that's really a disastrous policy and breaking that promise. In the most fundamental ways, we've been betrayed. But we were betrayed before he was even elected, before he won the Democratic nomination. He promised that he would join the filibuster against legislative retroactive immunity for the telecom companies for their criminal misconduct in cooperating with the Bush administration and its illegal surveillance program, spying on American citizens in our communications, our mail, our email, our telephone conversations. And so he promises to join the filibuster against it. He gets the nomination, and then he not only doesn't join the filibuster, he ends up voting for that legislation. Now, why did that bill pass? It's because three of the telecommunication companies that so egregiously violated the laws invested $12 million in their lobbyists. They turned the heat on, and Congress fell for it. And it's like they fall for big money almost every single time, and that's why we see such disastrous public policy coming out of Washington that is so contrary to the public interest. Remember President Obama's promise to close down Guantanamo? Well, that hasn't happened. He was going to make things better for the middle class in this country. Right now, if there's no other fact that people should keep in mind, consider 22% of children in this country are now living in poverty. And we have this unemployment rate. Our president hasn't, I mean, his pathetic jobs program proposal. Where is the proposal, the grand, large thinking of a Franklin Delano Roosevelt? Where are the WPAs and the CCCs? Where's the investment in infrastructure? Why aren't we educating our children to compete with children in other countries that are doing so much better, providing the foundation for their nation's future? It's because we have a president who is so timid, who is such apparently a terrible negotiator, but I think it's because he doesn't really have it in his core. I don't know if anybody in this country really knows what's important to this president other than staying in power and ingratiating himself to the moneyed interests, to those corporations and others with concentrated wealth who can help raise the $1 billion plus that he has committed to raise for this upcoming campaign.
Well, just in closing, Rocky Anderson, given that we have reached a point now, particularly since the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, where the power of money is greater than the power of votes, and we are clearly becoming, rapidly becoming a government of the plutocrats, by the plutocrats, and for the plutocrats, and you want to return us to a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, you feel that through the alternative media, you can get the message out. Do you feel, though, that the country is ripe, that the people are going to stand up? They seem passive, confused, and ill-educated.
I think it is the perfect storm right now. I felt for a number of years that people in this country were sound asleep, that they were anesthetized by so-called entertainment and sports and celebrity. But when you see things like the Occupy movement, I mean, look at the fact that there are people willing to sleep night after night in the cold, in the rain, committing themselves, and so many millions of people who are supportive of them. That is a really great sign. And I think the fact that people are becoming more and more aware, the Rasmussen poll showed some 57% of people saying they really want to see a new political party. There was a huge percentage of the respondents in that poll who said they would vote for the candidate of a new political party. So I think that although this country may not have been ready for this before now, it is now. I think people are so disgusted with what's going on in Congress, not only the political impasse over certain issues, but even when they agree, we all know that they are not serving our interests. And the White House is not serving our interests. People don't have jobs. People's 401k plans and pensions have been decimated. And at the same time, these guys that brought this economic disaster to this country are walking away with their pockets full of millions more in bonuses. It's just not right. It's not what the United States of America stands for any more than going around and kidnapping, disappearing, torturing people is what this country's all about. And it's time we turn this around, and it's up to the people. We can do it. That's what people need to understand. We all working today can do this, if only we will. So don't fall for this fear of, oh, geez, what if the worst of the worst succeed in this election? Let's pick the best option. Let's choose a return to government by, for, and of the people. Let's return to a government that represents the public interest rather than the narrow special interests of the corporations and other concentrated wealth.
Well, Rocky Anderson, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Really enjoyed it.
Again, Rocky Anderson was the mayor of Salt Lake City and is now running for the president of the United States in the 2012 election under the banner of the newly formed Justice Party. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the death of North Korea's dear leader.
Oh, I do believe if you don't like things you leave for some place you've never gone before.
To the man who would be king, I would say only one thing. And to the man who would be king, I would say only one thing. La 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 la.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Christine Ahn, the Executive Director of the Korea Policy Institute. She has addressed Congress, the United Nations, and the National Human Rights Commission in South Korea and has participated in several peace and humanitarian aid delegations to North Korea. She is the co-founder of the National Campaign to End the Korean War, Korean Americans for Fair Trade, and the global campaign to save Jeju Island. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Ahn.
Thank you, Ian, for having me.
And the death of Kim Jong-il, who's referred to in North Korea as the dear leader, comes at an ironic time, does it not? Just as tensions between the U.S. and North Korea appear to be easing with an agreement signed this weekend in Beijing, the U.S. is expected to send 240,000 tons of food aid to North Korea in exchange for North Korea's agreement to suspend work on its nuclear enrichment program. How will the death of the dear leader affect this?
That is definitely the question of the day, Ian. And, you know, what I fear is that the U.S. Intelligence community will kind of spin into what they did back in 1994 with the passing of Kim Jong-il's father, Kim Il-sung, for many, many years after Kim Il-sung's death, much of the rhetoric and analysis coming out of Washington, D.C., anticipated regime collapse, and which greatly influenced Washington and especially the White House decisions to in terms of U.S. policy. And we saw, in fact, U.S. policies shifting away from a potential breakthrough similar to what happened in 1994 with the agreed framework to a reversal of the policy of engagement towards essentially pursuing a regime change strategy, which is to further isolate North Korea, not send food aid when North Korea was on its knees begging for food aid, and intensifying sanctions against that country. So what Korean Americans, especially those who either have family in North Korea or South Korea, are hoping is, you know, we can speculate all we want about what will happen in North Korea, but what we can try to influence is the way our country and our political leaders choose to engage with North Korea, and that's what we certainly can try to have some control over.
Well, I'm curious to know what the intelligence community knows about North Korea, given apparently that they only had a picture of the new leader, the 20-something-year-old son, Kim Jong-un. They only had a picture of him as a small schoolboy in Switzerland. So they don't really know much about this regime. In fact, nobody does, right?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, I would probably be quoting correctly say would attribute to a statement from several CIA agents saying we don't know anything about North Korea. In fact, the thing is you know, what we do know is probably a lot more information that has been gleaned in the past decade by a lot of humanitarian aid experts who have either visited the country regularly or who have been based in North Korea. So they actually have a lot of insight, as well as some of the statistics that have been gathered by a lot of the groups monitoring the humanitarian situation in North Korea. But you're right. I mean, we know very little. What we do know is that in some of the photos that have been taken of Kim Jong-il's visits preceding his passing, there have been a number of North Korean leaders representing the Workers' Party and the military who have accompanied him, which, you know, might signal to those watching from the outside that, you know, there is a steady and consistent committee, a political body that will ensure the smooth transition of succession of power from Kim Jong-il to Kim Jong-un, the youngest son. So, but yes, I mean, again, this will all be conjecture because we just don't know enough. And But what we do know for sure with certainty is that pursuing peace, pursuing dialogue, pursuing engagement and reconciliation has actually proven to be very good for the people of North Korea in terms of their ability to access food, in terms of their ability to recalibrate from the devastated economy since the collapse of the socialist trading bloc. And it's good for the people in South Korea because they won't have to be in a constant state of alert and, you know, facing militarism that leads so much of their public dollars towards the financing of and preparation for war. So we know it's good for the people of North and South Korea, and it's good for regional stability. So hopefully the political leaders among the six-party talks countries will bear that in mind and pursue, a spirit of engagement and dialogue with North Korea.
Again, I'm speaking with Christine Ahn, who's the Executive Director of the Korea Policy Institute. She participated in several peace and humanitarian aid delegations to North Korea and is the co-founder of the National Campaign to End the Korean War, Korean Americans for Fair Trade, and the Global Campaign to Save Jeju Island. Now, the conventional wisdom is now that the military will be the kind of power brokers and that the North Korean government may fall back into a kind of conservative reflex, if you will. During this transition period, already the military has, I mean, they're already on military alert. What's your sense of that idea that suggests that the Sun has not really consolidated his position and that he relies heavily on the military, not to mention Jang Sung-thaek, who's apparently the power behind the throne. Let's start with that question. What do you know about this Eminence Gris character that's referred to as Jang Sung-thaek?
I don't know too much about him. I know that he's a brother-in-law to Kim Jong-il, and I know that he was appointed a general at the September conference where Kim Jong-un, the son, was named the successor. So this is, again, since we don't completely know what is happening, is that what I can say based on the experience of the last major political transition that took place in 1994 with the passing of Kim Il-sung is that this country and its political leadership is used to these transitions. And for some time now, since 2008 at the very latest or the earliest, we've known about Kim Jong-il's deteriorating health. And so steps have been made by the country's leadership, which I believe includes, a committee or several committees. There's clearly a well-oiled decision-making body that is going to ensure the smooth transition. Now, whether Kim Jong-un has the legitimacy in the eyes of the Korean people, I mean, who knows? Who knows any of this? But I have no doubt that we will see a period of stability, certainly in this period of great change and shock to the country, because they're used to it. And not only are they used to the political transitions, they're also used to pretty major shocks through whether it's the collapse of the socialist trading bloc, whether it's the famine, or whether it's the nuclear crisis that they experienced with the United States. So, I can't bet my life on it, but I can just tell by being an observer of North Korea and seeing just the country's ability to maintain stability amid tremendous turmoil and change that that they will be able to survive this period, and hopefully this will present some new opportunities for North Korea in terms of how the outside world will engage with North Korea, but also some of the political shifts that we're seeing taking place in South Korea, towards a more progressive and liberal government, and just that the winds of change will be blowing towards more open, more democratic, and hopefully the peaceful reconciliation and gradual reunification of the country.
So the what about winds of change, though, Christine Ahn, in the north, which clearly would be welcome, surely. The North Korean news agency, official news agency, has called upon the Korean people and the military to revere the respected comrade, Kim Jong-un. So what possible change would there be? And can you explain this kind of communist dynasty, if you will, and why this reverence, and why the people crying in the streets?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's it's a phenomenon that even somebody like myself, who is trying to understand the North Korean mindset, I can probably hardly even start to scratch the surface. But I would say that Kim Jong-il's legacy is a mixed one. I mean, on the one hand, you have a situation in which he took over North Korea at a time of tremendous political turmoil. They were on a brink of war with the United States. That was under Bill Clinton. His father had, that was when Jimmy Carter had gone to North Korea at a time to essentially prevent the Clinton administration from essentially preemptively striking North Korea. So that was not only that occurring, but there was the collapse of the socialist trading bloc. So its historic trading partners, China, the Soviet Union, had disintegrated. So the whole economy started to unravel. And then not to mention, as we know, as progressives, so much of the economy is tied to energy, and North Korea has been very highly dependent on foreign imports of oil to maintain, I mean, just even the basic things, such as running its tractors. So this, all of this kind of contributed to a massive food crisis and a famine that essentially killed up to 600,000 to up to 2 million people. I mean, it's hard to know what the exact figure is, but that is a significant percentage of the North Korean population. It has, it has had lasting scars on the people of North Korea. So you have all of this, and so Kim Jong-il assumes power amidst all of that, and he is in power, and he is unable to implement economic reforms that essentially returns the country to its state, from the preceding the 1980s, when North Koreans had a good quality of life. In fact, many will say that North Korea's economy far exceeded that of South Korea up until the late 1970s. And so he wasn't able to deliver in that sense, but I would say the kind of reverence has to do with the fact that Kim Jong-il was able to acquire a nuclear weapon. And I think that from the North Koreans' perspective, there's a certain kind of pride with that. And that hasn't to do with the fact that they want to use that nuclear weapon to terrorize the rest of the world, which is how it's perceived and portrayed in the Western and mainstream media. But it's that they can proudly claim it as a tool for self-defense. And that's where I think so much of the Korean, like understanding the Korean mindset, understanding the kind of political propaganda that has emerged from the last half century as a result of the direct real and lived experience of the North Korean people, whether it was the experience of Japanese occupation, and then followed by the division of the Korean Peninsula, and then the brutal Korean War, where nearly 70% of that country was bombed to bits. When I go to North Korea, I have this experience where one of the guides, you know, they would always point to this building in Pyongyang, and I would always be baffled, why are they so fascinated with this building? And in fact, it's because that was a restaurant that was one of the only standing buildings that survived the Korean War. I mean, otherwise, all the infrastructure in Pyongyang is virtually built in the post-war period. And so there is, you know, a certain kind of fierce mindset of the North Korean people that they want to be independent, they want to be sovereign, and in that sense, Kim Jong-il delivered. And so it is a mixed feeling, and I'm sure that the North Korean people are fatigued, and they're ready for better economic times. They're ready to have consistent food supplies. They're ready for a return to a life where they have regular sources of energy. And so, you know, but it has been, it's a complicated situation. And, but, you know, with the changing of hands, and we don't know much about Kim Jong-un, but what we do know is that he did study, you know, abroad. He, it sounds like he went to school in Switzerland. And, you know, he has an experience of what it's like to live outside of North Korea. And so hopefully that might also be a good thing, you know, to be a citizen of the international community and to help the country gradually move. But, you know, it takes two to tango. And, you know, the North Koreans have been wanting to engage with the global community and with the United States and to have normalized relations. So hopefully we'll see a reciprocation on this side of the Pacific Ocean.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Christine Ahn.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Christine Ahn, who's Executive Director of the Korean Policy Institute. She has addressed Congress, the United Nations, and the National Human Rights Commission in South Korea and has participated in several peace and humanitarian aid delegations to North Korea. She's the co-founder of the National Campaign to End the Korean War, Korean Americans for Fair Trade, and the Global Campaign to Save Jeju Island. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment talking with an early critic of the Iraq reconstruction fiasco. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Phillips, the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He is a director of the program on peacebuilding and rights at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and a fellow at Harvard University's Project on the Future of Diplomacy. He has worked as a senior advisor to the United Nations Secretariat and as a foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the United States Department of State. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you very much.
And what is your sense as the U.S. pulls out of Iraq? I did speak with an Iraqi to get an Iraqi perspective on it. And, of course, there's a lot of bitterness from the Iraqis about what's happened to their country. But there's also a sort of sense of they've been blaming everything on the Americans. And on the American side, there seems to be an equal delusion that they've actually done something good for the Iraqis. How do you come down on the post-mortem of this sorry chapter?
Iraq has an opportunity now that it would never have been able to achieve under the old regime. Whether or not the current leadership is up to the task remains to be seen. And so far, its immediate actions in the aftermath of the withdrawal of American troops doesn't do much to inspire confidence.
And I guess you're referring to the arrest warrant for the Sunni Arab vice president Tariq Hashimi and the whole Iraqiya bloc pulling out of the government.
Yes, that's part of it, but we shouldn't be surprised. There have been 300 leading Sunni Arab politicians who have been arrested. The Iraqi armed forces have sent tanks and parked them in front of the homes of some leading Sunni politicians. I mean, this is exactly what Saddam Hussein did when he came in. First he went after political opponents, then communists, then Nasserites, then the Kurds. Prime Minister Maliki is looking more and more like Saddam Hussein light.
And how come we didn't see this coming? Because I recall that that Ayad Alawi won the elections.
His bloc received the most votes, but he wasn't able to form a government.
Mm-hmm.
Did we see this coming? It's hard to imagine that U.S. officials were not aware. I think that in many respects, we preferred to be willfully ignorant. There was a campaign pledge made by Barack Obama, and he was committed to fulfilling that pledge. Unfortunately, that leaves Iraq in a bit of a mess, and now the U.S. doesn't have leverage over events there to influence the direction of the country the way we would like it to.
But apparently, Senator John McCain thinks we do, and that somehow Obama has dropped the ball. In fact, McCain made a very incendiary speech on the Senate floor a few days ago that was quite bitter and nasty and accused the president of basically being almost a traitor to American interests.
Well, that's going too far. Clearly, the U.S. needed to set a deadline as a challenge to Iraqis so that they could start governing the country by themselves. We have not been traitorous towards Iraqis. We didn't help them prepare for this moment adequately. We didn't foresee problems that would arise. And now we're moving forward with a big arms sales package to Iraq with F-16s and laser-guided bombs. And why does Iraq need these weapons? Is it a good idea for us to be selling it to them? There are a lot of questions about U.S. policy going forward.
Well, David Phillips, again, the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. It's pretty much established, isn't it, that the real winners of the Iraq war are the Iranians?
That's certainly correct. The government in Tehran wields extraordinary influence through Prime Minister Maliki and other politicians. It looks as though Iran is going to lose its proxy in Syria, and then it's going to refocus its efforts on Iraq to make sure that it's still able to exert regional influence.
So in terms of our politics, because it does seem that we're heading to some kind of confrontation with Iran, and the president was concerned about some of the language in the Defense Authorization Act that was perhaps too provocative in the sense that cutting off Iran's oil market or their ability to be paid for their oil might be seen as pushing them far to the wall. I believe there's some language in there that gives the president some flexibility. But do you see this situation as heading towards some kind of conflict between both the U.S., Israel, and the Sunni Arabs versus an Iranian regime that seems to be increasingly isolated?
I mean, here again, there already is a conflict. The Iranian students stormed and ransacked the British embassy. There's clearly a conflict between Western countries and the EU as a whole and the regime in Tehran. If anything, the U.S. has been leading from behind on this one as well, trying to find some accommodation lest a complete boycott of Iran's energy supplies drive prices up. The EU has been much more forward on this. What's clear is that there's a unified view in the international community that Iran is a rogue regime on the verge of weaponizing its nuclear program. And if it makes that strategic decision, that is no longer an existential threat to the Sunni Arab world and to Israel, as well as the United States. It becomes a real threat, and then we have a serious conundrum on our hands.
So is it possible that given the irrational behavior or the apparently irrational behavior of the Iranian regime in setting loose the besieged militia to sack the British embassy, although there are some rumors that that's to do with internal fights between the head of the parliament and the president. It doesn't leave one with much comfort in terms of stability in that region. Would it be possible in Iraq, with no longer any American troops there, with contractors largely protecting the green zone and the Basra consulate being quite vulnerable, is it possible, do you think, in the near future that an Iranian-backed militia could make a move on U.S. interests?
That's happened repeatedly since we entered Iraq. The Sadrists and the Sadr's fighters have been in active conflict with U.S. forces since 2003. So there's a pattern for that. And clearly Iran is behind Muqtadir al-Sadr's activities. So that represents a real threat. Whether or not there's going to be an actual attack against the Green Zone or against the U.S. consulate in Erbil or down in the south, I can't speculate. But the situation in Iraq is volatile. Iraqi politics is unstable. Iran is playing an extremely unhelpful role. It's stoking the flames of confrontation, and we need to be very vigilant. Things are going to get worse before they get better.
So given the emergence of Iran as a power in this region, which I think can be directly traced to the fact that the U.S. got rid of two of their enemies. They got rid of the Taliban on one side, who perhaps were more of an irritant than an enemy, although at one point Iran almost went to war with the Taliban. And then, of course, getting rid of Saddam, who'd been a sort of check and balance against Iranian emergence, particularly in what the Sunni Arabs refer to as the Shiite Crescent. Do you think there'll be an accounting on this side? I mean, I always recall how Brent Scowcroft warned about going into Baghdad for the very reasons that we've just mentioned. But clearly his warnings were not taken seriously. And I've always been puzzled why, since Brent is so close to former President Bush, why somehow Bush Jr. was not restrained in any way.
If you look back at the rhetoric in 2002, the advisors to President Bush, 41, were all opposed to going into Iraq. You can find quotes from Dick Cheney when he was the Secretary of Defense warning against occupying Iraq, lest the country fragment and become a theater for Iran's interests. Bush 43 ignored all those warnings. The risks posed by the war in Iraq are now even more alarming, given the fact that we've withdrawn from the country and no longer have the kind of political influence that we had when there were troops on the ground. I also want to return to this issue, Ian, of weapons sales. If the rationale in providing the Iraqi armed forces with F-16s and 2,000-pound bombs and laser-guided bombs is somehow to act as a deterrent against Iran, we need to establish some conditionality on those weapons sales, that those weapons will not be used against other Iraqis, and that there's some kind of ongoing security cooperation between Baghdad and Washington, so we're able to influence security events in the region. It seems to me to be an awfully risky affair, given Baghdad's history of turning on its own citizens and Maliki's propensity towards centralizing power, to provide him with those very sophisticated weapons that are more likely to be used against his own citizens than against Iran's influence or other countries in the region that might seek to do harm to Iraq.
So given what we're discussing here in terms of the reality of how much we have sort of created Iran as the hegemon there in the area, because the contrast is pretty stark when you consider Bush Sr. was able to evict Saddam from Kuwait and get the Saudis and the Japanese to pay for that war. And we were then reestablished, the U.S. was reestablished as the hegemon in that area where its economic rivals got their energy supply. Now it seems like the U.S. doesn't have much influence in that region, and they've tried to persuade India not to buy oil from Iran and gotten nowhere on that. I was just reading recently a book about Chalabi's influence in all of this, which raises the question of how foreign actors can infiltrate U.S. foreign policy and literally get America involved in its greatest diplomatic and military disaster in its history, all the while Chalabi being an agent of the Iranians. I mean, it's breathtaking. You've written about the post-war reconstruction fiasco. Does any of this still make you angry that these players have gotten away with, you know, the neocons plus their champion Chalabi have gotten away with so much?
I've written about Chalabi's role, and it's extraordinary how he was able to play the U.S. off against Iran. So does that make me angry, you know, as a U.S. citizen, having witnessed the death of 4,500 U.S. servicemen and women and seeing $1 trillion in treasure spent in Iraq? Of course I'm angry about that. There's an interesting question that's now being raised by former Bush administration officials. They're trying to establish a link between the Arab Spring and the decapitation of the regime in Baghdad. You can see this kind of revisionism underway as a form of justification for the decision to invade Iraq. And I'm sure that this kind of discussion is going to continue in the years to come. President Bush has always said that history will be his judge. Well, history is now unfolding, and it's clear that Iraq and other countries in the region are turning against the United States. All of this should give us real cause for concern about using military action to overthrow regimes when there is no active rebellion underway.
So what explains then the neoconservatives' continued presence in the media, having any credibility whatsoever? Even one of the Republican debates was conducted with all the neocon architects of the Iraq War acting as elder statesmen. I'm just astounded as to why, when the record is so clear on how disastrous they've been. And, you know, I recall that the founder of the neoconservative movement, Irving Kristol, once said that neoconservatives are liberals who've been mugged by reality. Well, you'd think that reality by now would have mugged these reckless amateurs.
And the reality is that Iraqis celebrated our departure. Iraq's political leaders have turned on the United States. Our interests aren't being served there. Our security is diminished. Our oil access is also much less than that of other countries. So what did we accomplish after having invested so much in Iraq? Are Iraqis going to be up to the challenge of seizing this opportunity? There's no reason to be hopeful that the new Iraq is moving in the right direction. We need to learn some lessons from our experience in Iraq so that when we intervene in other conflicts, as we have recently in Libya, we're planning the post-war period and transitions to democracy more effectively. I guarantee you that Iraq will not be the last time that the U.S. intervenes militarily. We will see other instances when humanitarian intervention to stop genocide is a compelling cause, and we need to get it right in the future.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, David Phillips.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you.
Likewise. And we've been speaking with David Phillips, author of Losing Iraq, Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He is the director of the program on peacebuilding and rights at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and a fellow at Harvard University's Project on the Future of Diplomacy. He has worked as a senior advisor to the United Nations Secretariat and as a foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the United States Department of State. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.